Chapter 10. The last call was 100% a seedy dive bar, so the fact I was here to meet Owen McElfrish to talk about the most illegal business I'd ever been involved in seemed fitting. The parking lot was all gravel instead of paved, and the paint on the front of the building was faded and chipping. Even the yellow plastic sign with the bar's name printed in black letters seemed disreputable. I walked in and could smell cigarette smoke, despite the fact that smoking indoors had been banned over a decade ago, and the interior of the bar looked like it was made exclusively from dark wood paneling. To one side there were two pool tables, with worn green velvet, and both were currently in use. There were also booths with old, faded red vinyl cushions, and a few tables scattered here and there. The bar took up the whole back wall, and one of the mirror panels along the back wall had a large crack in it. The patrons all seemed to be 50 years old or older, and there were a lot of biker jackets in sight. I tried to keep my head down and looked around until I saw Owen leaned back comfortably in one of the beat-up booths and looking at his phone. Then I walked over and sat down on the opposite side of the table.
"Eddie!"
McElfrish looked up from his phone and spoke in a tone that implied we were old friends. Owen was a short man with a big personality, and his dark mass of hair was carefully coiffed into a pompadour, which helped to give him another couple of inches in height. The Irishman was dressed in a pair of tight, dark blue skinny jeans and a form-fitting black t-shirt that really just showed how Owen had a little beer gut. "How's it going?" I asked as I settled in on the squeaking vinyl.
"More than fine,"
McElfrish said with a grand gesture as he called a waitress over to the table.
"Would you like something to drink?"
Just a beer is fine," I replied with a shrug.
"Another whiskey?"
A young red-headed waitress in a scandalously short skirt asked the businessman as she came up to the table.
"Yes,"
Owen nodded.
"And a pint for me friend, if you would?"
"Of course, Owen."
The redhead smiled and then sauntered away to get our drinks.
"No,"
McElfrish said, and he was suddenly all business as he pulled out a little pad of paper and a pen.
"You need a fresh identity. Are you looking for a man or a woman?"
"Two women, actually," I replied after I looked around to make sure there was no one listening nearby.
"Good for you."
Owen chuckled after a low whistle.
"And don't you worry. No one here cares what we have to say to each other. It's why I asked you to meet me here."
"Fair enough," I said as I looked back at the short man. Just then, the waitress dropped off the drinks, and I watched as Owen handed her a $50 bill and didn't ask for any change back. I could see why he didn't need to worry about conducting business in this bar.
"About how old are these women?"
McElfrish continued, and he grimaced as he took a swig of his whiskey. "Early 20s?" I said as I sipped on my beer.
"Hair and eye color?"
Owen asked while he wrote some quick notes on his pad. "The first woman has violet eyes and white hair," I said, "and the other has sort of reddish blonde hair and black eyes." Owen stopped writing and looked at me with a raised eyebrow.
"All right, but what is their natural hair and eye colors?"
"I don't know." I lied, since I knew if I said those were their natural hair and eye colors, Owen would think I was out of my fucking mind. When I met them, both of the ladies had already had their appearances permanently changed. They're dedicated cosplayers. They've altered the color of their skin and everything. So, really, we could say their natural hair color was whatever, because no one will ever see it anyway. The dark-haired man sat there and stared at me for a tense moment, as if he were deciding how to continue after hearing this information.
"I'm assuming they're both hot as balls?"
McElfrish finally snorted. "Oh, yeah," I nodded emphatically. "Like crazy hot."
"Well, I've heard stranger things,"
Owen chuckled.
"I once helped a guy who was tattooed head to toe to look like a lizard. He'd had his tongue surgically split and everything. Nicest guy, though. So, about how tall are these women?"
The short Irishman kept asking me questions about Ibsith and Amrila so we could find or create some identities that matched them as closely as possible. Owen didn't bother to explain how it all worked exactly, and I frankly didn't want to know. As long as the new identities held up well enough to keep immigration away from my door, I didn't care how it happened.
"All right,"
McElfrish said after he was finished with his questions.
"You've got a couple of different options here. I could get you a couple of foreign birth certificates, and you can try your luck with the Department of Homeland Security. Or I can get you something that'll say the girls are American, born and raised. The only problem with this second option is if they don't sound like Americans. If ICE ever shows up at your door, they might look a little closer if the ladies don't sound like natives.
Is there any option in the middle? I asked. Something that says they were born in Eastern Europe but live here legally now?
If there is, it's not easy to get a hold of,
Owen said as he spread his hands apologetically.
The whole thing works when no one's looking too closely. If someone with very little family dies and their social security number is used in another state for a few years, no one asks too many questions. I suppose you could get counterfeit immigration papers, but in the digital age, it's too easy to verify information with just a click of a button.
All right. I nodded as I thought over the options. I guess I'll go with the second option, then. Maybe I could give Ipsith and Amrila lessons on different American accents, depending on where their papers said they came from. We could turn it into a fun game.
Fantastic, McElfresh said. We'll say that's about $5,000?
I replied in a surprised tone. That's a lot less than I thought it would be, not that I'm complaining.
That's all?
Owen smiled an oily smile.
I'll get you a birth certificate, social security numbers, mother's maiden names, the works, for only $5,000. But
somehow I knew there was going to be a but.
Since I'm giving you a friends and family discount,
McElfresh continued,
maybe you can do me a kindness in the future. You seem to be a resourceful man, and it won't be anything too crazy.
I have a background in construction, I offered, since I didn't like how open-ended the Irishman's offer was. Maybe I could do some handiwork for you or something?
See.
Owen's smile widened.
Who doesn't need a few things done around the house? Do we have a deal?
Sure, I said after a small pause, and I shook McElfresh's hand.
Give me a few days.
The dark-haired man stood and polished off the last of his whiskey.
I'll give you a call when I have everything squared away.
Thanks, I said by way of farewell before I left the dive bar. I drove away from the last call and headed back to Westhurst with one more thing checked off my ever-growing mental to-do list. If Owen came through with two convincing identities for Ipsith and Amrila, I wouldn't have to worry about Brock's thinly-veiled threats anymore. It wouldn't end my problems with nosy neighbors, but it was one more thing I didn't have to worry about. As I pulled into my driveway about an hour later, my thoughts turned to the next immediate concerns, which were the hooded figure in the surface tunnels and the shadow creature lurking in the gloom. I waited until breakfast the next morning to bring it up to the women. The night had passed without incident, so nothing set off the alarms I'd set up in the tunnels. But this could just mean the figure had been watching me as I set up the field cameras and floodlights and guessed their purpose. If the hooded figure knew where the traps and cameras were, they might have been able to avoid detection. I still only had a basic knowledge of the twisting tunnel system, so it was possible the figure could know alternate routes to avoid my traps, but that was just speculation on my part. I was thinking about going back into the gloom. I said to the ladies as we sat around the coffee table eating sausage, eggs, and toast.
So soon, my love?
Ipsith asked with the familiar sense of apprehension she always spoke with when the topic of the gloom came up. I was thinking about the lesser demon thing Amrila and I saw. I set my fork down and looked back and forth between the two women. Amrila, you said the Dolrath are warriors and would have killed the demon if they knew it was in their territory. If that fucker is partly responsible for the attacks in the gloom, which have been going on for a while, then they must not know where it is, or that it's down there.
Yes, and I am sure they would be looking for what has been killing and mutilating the people in their lands,
Amrila said with a nod.
I grew up around the Dolrath. They wouldn't sit around and do nothing.
But as far as we know, I said as I rolled the problem around in my head, we're the only ones who've ever seen that thing and lived to tell the tale.
As far as we know,
Amrila repeated in a skeptical tone.
That was days ago. They might have found and killed the thing by now.
Well, I rubbed my chin as a plan formed in my mind. On the chance they haven't, if we go back and tell them about the shadow creature, maybe even help them find and hunt it down, they might be grateful for the help.
They might even be willing to help you fight against Dursinger.
Ipsith finished my thought for me. Exactly, I nodded. We have it pretty good up here right now. But as long as Ursinger is kicking around somewhere under our feet, we have to be on our guard. He has an army, but if we have some friends down in the gloom, fighting Ursinger becomes a whole lot easier. And I, for one, will breathe a whole lot easier once I know that fucking creepy fucker isn't looking for Ibsith anymore.
There is wisdom in your thinking,
Amrila said as a devilish grin tugged at her red lips.
And any excuse to fuck up the day of that ass is considered a win in my book.
If we're all on board, I said as I stood and picked up my plate to take into the kitchen, then I think we should go through the southern tunnels again. It's the quickest way to the Dolrath territory. Right, partner?
Yes.
The horned woman replied, but then her face blanched.
But there are other ways, too. Ones that don't involve those ridiculous traps.
I wasn't a fan of them either. I agreed as I moved toward the kitchen. But we know how to deal with him now. Not to mention, we should poke around a little while we're down there and see if we can find any sign of whatever the hooded figure is. Ibsith stood and crossed the living room and followed me into the kitchen. And as I set the plate in the sink, I felt her arms wrap around me. I turned and put both my arms around her small shoulders, and then I held her tightly against my chest.
Be safe, my beloved.
The elven woman breathed. I will be, I said, as I kissed the top of her head and smelled the clean scent of her silky hair. And I'll have Amrila there to watch my back. We'll return before you know it.
I know you will be.
The blue-skinned woman smiled sweetly up at me, even though her eyes were twinged with sadness.
But our bed is so cold when you are not in it.
I kissed my wife long and slow to reassure her of the way I felt. I could feel her body respond to mine beneath my hands, and I knew without words that she'd understood. After that, Amrila and I set about gathering and checking the supplies and equipment we felt we needed for a few days in the gloom. We got together all the usual things like guns, ammo, water canteens, some food, and so on, but I had to talk Amrila into taking a flashlight for herself.
I will not have any use for it,
the red-skinned woman protested.
These things half blind me. I might as well walk around blindfolded.
But if we run into that lesser demon again, I countered as I held out the heavy-duty flashlight. Light is the only thing we know of that can affect it. And this thing puts out a hell of a light.
I remember,
Amrila said as she looked at the metal flashlight with narrowed eyes.
And to be fair, my father's sword did have some effect on it.
A little, I snorted. Just take it. With any luck, you won't need it.
Fine.
The horned woman sighed, but she took the flashlight all the same. Then Amrila grabbed my old AK while I armed myself with my Galil and Glock, and we said one last goodbye to Ibsith by the back door before we moved quietly into the backyard. It was the middle of the day, but the privacy fence helped to keep out prying eyes. If old Lady Whitmire or the Millers were in their backyard, though, we didn't want to make a lot of noise and draw attention to ourselves. Ibsith stood by the back door and silently watched Amrila and I as we disappeared into the lilac bushes, and I cast my wife one more smile over my shoulder before I crouched down among the fragrant branches, opened the metal doors, and lowered myself down. Once I was at the bottom of the ladder, Amrila threw down the backpacks and then descended the ladder also, and her sunglasses were perched firmly over her eyes to help her through the floodlights placed throughout the surface tunnels. The horned woman was also wearing her leather armor, and as much as the Zinkari woman had come to love her short shorts and tank tops, she always seemed the most confident in her tight, black leathers. But I could tell she still wasn't used to carrying the AK, and I'd admit it seemed like a lot of equipment with her dual swords on her hips and a backpack too. But it was better safe than sorry, and the AK definitely made me feel safer. Careful to keep an eye out for the bear traps, I said as I handed the black-eyed woman her backpack. Remember, they're all placed around corners, so look before you step, just in case we don't remember where they all are.
Simple enough.
Amrila huffed and shouldered her pack. Then we headed for the southern tunnels, and we worked our way toward the tunnels of the Lost Dwarves. As we walked through the floodlights and trail cameras, I was pleased to see they all seemed to be in working order. The floodlights flashed on as soon as we came within the range of their motion sensors, and I could see the small, red lights on the trail cameras come on as we passed. My security system was working just like I'd intended, and a warm sense of accomplishment spread through my chest. But as we got closer to the dwarven tunnels, that feeling was replaced with dread as the sounds of low moans came up the dark passageways past my security systems. Amrila and I stopped and listened for a moment while we looked at one another.
Is it the thing you saw down here?
The red-skinned woman whispered as she raised one eyebrow. It could be, I hissed back, and I looked down the tunnel where the sound was coming from. I didn't hear it make any sound last time, though. It just ran away. I raised my Galil to my shoulder and nodded my head in the direction of the groans, and Amrila nodded back and pulled out her swords, ready to follow behind me. I knew my headlamp would give away our location, but the tunnels would be pitch black to me without it, so I kept it on. Then we moved carefully toward the sound, step by step, and I could feel my heartbeat in my fingertips as the adrenaline in my blood made me hyper-aware of my surroundings. The soft sounds of our feet on the cold stone beneath us and the odd draft of cool air that came down the tunnel all filtered into my awareness in sharp focus. As we came to a turn in the passageway, I realized this was one of the places Amrila and I had placed one of the bear traps. Then we came around the corner, and sure enough, I could see the trap had been set off, and there was a small, stout man in a dark cloak with his leg in the trap. I recognized the man was a dwarf from my time in Bermshire, and my interactions with the dwarven blacksmith there, but this dwarf looked ancient, with a long white beard. His lined, craggy face was contorted in pain as he tried to pry the strong jaws of the trap open, but every time he had to stop to catch his breath, the trap would clamp down again and cause him to groan. When the light of my headlamp came around the turn in the tunnel, the white-bearded dwarf looked up and shielded his eyes with one hand.
Niggoth's granite teeth!
The dwarf swore.
Are you trying to blind and cripple me?
Who are you? I asked in a stern tone with my Galil at the ready. The small man was clearly incapacitated, but until I knew how and why he was in the tunnels, I didn't want to let my guard down.
Tsagor!
The dwarf spat.
Who the fuck are you?
How did you get up here? I demanded and ignored Sagor's question.
I live here!
The white-bearded man rumbled.
Please, help me out of this thing. I'm not armed. I suspect my leg is broken.
I looked at the dwarf's leg and could see the torn, bloody fabric of his cloth pants. The sight of the blood caused my stomach to clench, but I still wasn't going to get into arm's reach of the guy until I was sure he wasn't here for some nefarious purpose.
What are we gonna do?
Amrila hissed behind me. We'll help you, I said loudly enough for Sagor to hear. But first, I need you to lift up your cloak and show me you're not armed.
Ah!
The old dwarf groaned, but he lifted the side of his black cloak to show he had no weapons on him. As the cloak came up, I could also see more of Sagor's ruined leg. I could even see where the trap had bit through the dwarf's flesh and saw the glint of his exposed leg bone. The dwarf had lost a fair amount of blood, and I wondered how long he'd been in the trap. Fuck, I said out loud as I handed my Galil over to Amrila and rushed over to help Sagor. I walked up to the ancient dwarf, knelt down, and pressed the release for the trap down. Sagor's leg came free, and the old man fell to the ground now that he was finally released from the metal jaws.
Ah!
Sagor grunted through gritted teeth, and the ancient dwarf held his shredded leg as he laid on the floor.
By the gods!
Amrila came up behind me with her sword still in her hand, and she stood over my shoulder as I tried to help the old man. Let me take a look, I said in a firm but kind tone as I pried the bearded man's stubby fingers away from the wound. Either side of the dwarf's leg had been lacerated by the bear trap, and I could see a small white glint of bone. I was sure the man's leg was broken, too, but I didn't want to manipulate the area to confirm it. This is really bad, I said to Amrila, who was just behind me.
Oh, no shite!
Sagor replied in a strained tone.
So glad you came along to tell me that.
Do you want our help or not? I sighed.
Yes,
he grunted.
Okay, sorry. Can you help me?
Is there anywhere we can take you? I asked. Without any help, I was afraid the old dwarf might bleed out before long. I was also concerned about the possibility of infection and making sure the leg healed correctly, but the immediate worry was getting the stocky man patched up. The bearded man stared at me warily and then looked down at his leg as if weighing the risks of trusting me against the risk of dying of blood loss.
Down the next passage to the southwest,
Sagor said with a reluctant huff.
about a quarter mile from the old baths. But I have to warn you, the others aren't going to like this.
The others?
Amrila repeated, but my mind had jumped a step ahead. You're one of the Lost Tribe, I blurted out.
Can't hardly be lost if I'm right in front of you,
Sagar grumbled.
No more talk, though. Just get me to the others.
Sagar wasn't a large man, but he was solidly built, so it took a fair amount of effort between the horned woman and I to lift him and help him down the tunnels. We settled on having Sagar put an arm over either of our shoulders and having him dangle between us. It wasn't terribly dignified, but it was better than carrying him by the arms and feet and possibly fucking up his leg further. Sagar directed us through the dwarven corridors, and I recognized several places where I'd chased the hooded figure, which I now assumed was Sagar. We carried the stout man through the echoing blue-tiled room where I'd given up the chase, and then we took the passage to the west. The old dwarf continued to direct us through the abandoned dwarven stronghold, and I started to get a sense for the ancient civilization that had built these halls and lived here long ago. Where are the others? I asked as I glanced over an abandoned courtyard that looked like it might have once been a market. These passages seem completely empty.
No civilization is an island,
Sagar intoned quietly next to me.
Without other tribes to mix with, we started to die out, either from hereditary diseases or just not enough partners to go around. Now there are only four of us left.
Why didn't you go back to the gloom?
Amrila asked as we entered a long corridor where there were strange lanterns glowing on the wall. I could also hear the hushed sounds of gruff voices as they came down the corridor from a dimly lit room up ahead.
There are fates worse than death,
the bearded man said in a low tone. Before we could ask him what he meant, Amrila and I carried Sagar through the threshold of the lit room. It was a huge space filled with long, heavy wooden tables, low wooden chairs with stretched leather for their seats, and what looked like a sleeping area in one corner. Sitting at various tables were three other dwarves, and each looked older than the last. Then the dwarves' startled expressions turned to concern as they looked up and saw the Zinkari woman, me, and Sagar hanging between us.
Put him down, fiend!
One dwarf in a gray tunic shouted as he stood and marched up the length of the room towards us.
Doram,
Sagar said in a faint voice.
No need for insults. If they meant me harm, I wouldn't have brought me here.
Unless this abomination just wanted you to lead her here,
the dwarf in gray accused. I looked over at Amrila and saw her bristling. Clearly words like fiend or abomination had a special significance for Zinkari, and it wasn't good. The other dwarves had also gotten up from their work tables and were warily approaching us. One was even shorter than the rest and still had a little red in his beard. The other dwarf seemed powerfully built, despite his advanced age, and he'd picked up a sword from somewhere.
Watch who you're calling names, half-pint!
Amrila spat at the dwarf called Doram.
We brought your friend as a kindness, but that won't stop me from cutting an inch or two off of you.
No, no,
Sagar said from where he was still dangling unceremoniously between the red-skinned woman and me.
Let's not let things get out of hand. Please, set me down. My leg is throbbing.
As Amrila and I set the wounded dwarf in the nearest chair, the smallest dwarf quickly brought another chair up and propped Sagor's wounded leg up so he could examine it.
It looks like a troll tried to bite it off,
the little dwarf said in a clear tenor voice.
It was a contraption,
Sagar grunted as his friend looked over the wounds.
It was shaped like a set of metal jaws, which snapped together when a pressure plate was triggered.
And your dumbass stepped into it?
The smallest dwarf asked as he started to cut away Sagor's pant leg with a dagger.
It was cleverly hidden, Sagar replied. The person who placed it was clearly a master of deception and ensnarement. How else would I have been caught? Who could set such a trap?
The burly dwarf demanded. I did, I said a little sheepishly.
What?
Doram nearly shouted, and his wrinkled face slowly turned red.
You are responsible for crippling our greatest artificer.
The trap was sitting out in the open around a corner,
Amrila groaned.
Anyone with two working eyes and a brain should have seen it there plain as the beards on your dumb faces.
I didn't know it was you down here, I said as I frowned and stood to my full height. We thought it might be a demon. You all clearly knew I was down in the tunnels. One of you was following me around a few days ago. If you would have said, "Hey, just us, the last of a lost civilization, no need to worry," I wouldn't have set out bear traps.
How dare you blame us?
The burly dwarf took a threatening step forward, with his sword still in his hand.
Enough, Torik!
Sagor scolded.
The boy said he didn't know, and how could he?
Yeah,
scoffed the dwarf, working on Sagor's leg.
He wouldn't know that you trip over your own beard every 5 minutes, and you're nearly blind as a dead mudworm. The lad could have screamed at you to watch out for the trap, and you probably would have blundered into it anyway.
Oh, shut up!
Sagor groaned.
You shut up!
The other dwarf snickered.
I'm the one fixing your leg, aren't I? Maybe if you did less talking and more looking where you were walking, you wouldn't be in this mess. You should leave all the same,
Doran said to me with thinly veiled contempt.
And take your half-breed friend with you.
Amrila squared her shoulders and looked like she was about to say something, and I put my hand on her shoulder.
We'll leave, I said slowly, but you should know we're still going to use the main corridor that leads to the iron door.
Do as you will,
Doran spat.
But mind the traps from now on. We don't have time to reset the spikes every time you're feeling clumsy, and I sure as hell don't want to have to scrub your remains off them. Just leave us alone.
Fair enough. I started to turn to leave, and Amrila moved to follow, but then I felt a hand touch my arm and saw Sagor had reached out to stop me. The smallest dwarf was still tending to his leg, but the other two had turned to go back to whatever they'd been doing before.
You never told me who you are,
Sagor said, as he looked up at me with curiosity laced beneath the pain in his eyes. I'm Eddie, I replied.
And you are from the surface world?
The white-bearded dwarf asked with a direct look that implied he already knew the answer. I just stared back at Sagor. He had guessed, and I wasn't going to confirm it. I wasn't sure if these dwarves had any interest in going up to the surface. I suppose they would have already if they wanted to, but I wasn't about to tell them the way all the same.
The point is,
Sagor said after a long pause,
we're the last of our tribe, and we've grown old. When we're gone, someone else will need to guard these sacred holes. By default, that person seems to be you.
Even if he keeps a half-breed as a companion?
Amrila replied in a tone ringing with challenge.
You are only part demon.
The wounded dwarf winced as the smaller one began to clean the wound with water from a pitcher and a clean rag.
Not all of us see you as a monster, but there are things in the Twilight Region and deeper dark that need to be kept there, guarded against, and we'll not be here much longer to do that.
Come now, you ass. Don't speak of such things.
The dwarf tending to his legs sighed. Sagor ignored him, took a large gold ring with a deeply red stone off his stout finger, and handed it to me.
You will have to be the protector of these holes now, and stand watch against the darkness,
he intoned in a solemn voice. That was kind of my plan, I said, and took the ring from the white-bearded dwarf. What's this?
It will keep you safe from the traps our ancestors placed throughout these holes,
Sagor replied.
Doran will not like that,
the smaller dwarf muttered as he looked at the gold ring in my hand.
Let Doran fuss, Becklin,
Sagor chuckled darkly.
None of us have much longer to listen anyway.
Thank you, I said to the older dwarf, since I wasn't sure how else to respond to the man's bleak humor. I really am sorry about your leg.
Perhaps it was fate.
The ancient dwarf shrugged as he watched Becklin begin to bandage his leg.
Be well, Eddie, and you also, miss.
Amrila smiled warmly at the wounded dwarf, and we both left the lost dwarf's final home to journey back into the lands of the Dolrath.